right to vote. And this is an extremely important part of our democratic system. It is one of the most powerful exercises of your right of free expression that you have as a citizen of the United States. It is a fundamental right in a democratic society. And so these are some of the terms that we'll get into, everything from polling place to apathy, because we do need to discuss why people don't vote. And so, of course, the big question as we get into this first part is, should it be considered a duty to vote, or a right, or a responsibility? Is it something that people should feel compelled to do? Because sadly, not everyone does feel compelled to do this. So first off, how do you get to vote? We know that it is a sacred right that we have as Americans that we get to vote. But we also hopefully understand that it is a responsibility. The survival of our very country depends on the willingness of the electorate to cast their votes. We also probably know that historically many people were not allowed to vote. For example, in the very beginning of our country's history, if you did not own property, you did not get to vote. If you were a female, you did not get to vote. If your skin was not white, you did not get to vote. But as we know, all of these things have changed. Now, women can vote as of 1920. African Americans can vote as of the passage of the 15th Amendment. And even Native Americans can vote as of the Indian Reorganization Act of 1924. So, historically disenfranchised groups can now participate in the political process. Did you know that once upon a time, you could be 18 years old and not be allowed to vote? This was changed after the Vietnam War, when soldiers were fighting and dying for a country that they could not participate in the political process of. So, once again, these were the people who could vote through early American history. At the very beginning, it was only white, male, property owners. And this was generally because our founding fathers did not trust women, or the poor, or minorities. Only the wealthy, the white, the men were considered full enfranchised citizens. Now, of course, we believe as a people that the right to vote shall not be denied because of race, color, gender, or even age, assuming that the person is 18 or older. Did you know that you can lose your right to vote? If you are convicted of a serious crime, you can lose your right to vote. It is a right that can be taken away. Now, to be able to vote, you must be 18. Of course, you're writing an essay questioning whether or not that should be lowered to 16. But for now, it's 18. You must be a resident of the state for a specified amount of time. Essentially, you must establish your residency in the state before you can vote in its elections. It's a bit of paperwork, but it doesn't take that long. In 2008, I moved to North Carolina from Tennessee. It took me a little bit of time at the tag office to get my North Carolina license plate, to establish my North Carolina address, to get my North Carolina driver's license, to register to vote in North Carolina. I did all of that in one stop. It was a bit of paperwork, but they walked me right through it. I established my residency. I moved here July 30th, 2008, and I voted in the election, the presidential election, in the same fall of that year. So. Now, to register to vote, you must do this at least 25 days prior to the election. So you must register in an appropriate amount of time. But again, if you get your driver's license, you can just check that box and then you're good. Some states vary. Some states don't require the waiting period. Some states make it even more difficult. Some states require voter IDs. I mean, you have to provide a state-issued identification to be able to vote. And you will, the first time you go to vote, you will need to provide identification to verify that you are who you say you are. Okay, so the question about the history of voting is that people began to ask between 1824 and 1828, is it fair to require someone to own property to be able to vote? And that's why by 1828 that law was done away with. Okay, so the next question, which is really not that complicated, is how do you vote? What does it involve? Well, first off, you will go to your polling place. A polling place is very simply the location where you go to vote. For me, it's Little River Community Center, this little building next to a church. Lines aren't that bad because I live in the boondocks. If you live right in the Hendersonville city limits, it may be the courthouse, but there, I'm sure there's a specific polling place. And you will go to vote in your precinct. That means for me, it's Little River. For you, it may be Hendersonville, Edneyville, etc. A precinct is the geographic area that contains a specific number of voters. So depending on the election, in a general election, it may not be so specific, but in an election particular to your precinct, you must go to that place to cast your ballot. Okay, when you get there, if you go on the actual voting day, you can choose to vote early and you can avoid an awful lot of crowds, but maybe you decide to go on the actual voting day. Most employers will give you the day off if necessary. They'll certainly give you the time to go vote. Like here at the Henderson County Public Schools, we are allowed to leave work early so that we can vote. Most employers will work that out for you. When you go, the first thing that someone is going to hand you as you walk into the building is a sample ballot. A ballot is the list of candidates on which you'll be voting. Hopefully it's not the first time you've seen them. In a general election, most people know who the president of each, most people know who the candidate for president of each party is. You might even know a few of the congressmen or senators. But there's a number of items that you're gonna have to decide on when you go to vote. And it would be in your best interest to look up what the ballot looks like ahead of time so you know what you're deciding about. For example, there might be referendums. There might be things you're voting on in terms of laws. The sheriff might be up for election. In fact, I just saw a billboard for the sheriff. He is up for re-election this year. So when that representative comes to talk to us, ask him the tough questions because they want your vote. Same with the judge, same with the county commissioners. And those are people that you're gonna need to educate yourself about as well. Okay, you're gonna meet a couple of folks when you go to vote. You're gonna meet clerks and challengers who have specific responsibilities. And there will be election judges there. These are generally volunteers. Although now a representative of the federal government is required to be at all of these polling places. So there'll be one representative and then lots of volunteers. The representative is there to make sure everything's on the up and up. And then again, the volunteers are just there to help. So the types of voting machines you are likely to see. I'll go ahead and tell you, in Henderson County, you're not going to deal with a punch card machine. You will have a computer-operated voting booth. And it may also, to keep a secondary record, when you cast your ballot, you're going to hear it punch a card. The computer will punch the card for you, and it will register your vote electronically. Some of the older machines had levers, and were manual devices. I do remember those from the Stone Age, but it's been a while, so. In our country, we believe in the secret ballot. I'm never going to tell you who I vote for. It's my business. I believe it would be unethical for me as your teacher to tell you who I vote for. And so I appreciate that we have the secret ballot. It is public knowledge if you vote or not. That is actually something that is registered. But you are not required to disclose who you vote for at any time, and no one can compel you to disclose that information. If your employer tries to ask you who you vote for and then tries to press you after you decline to answer, that is grounds for a lawsuit. You might wind up with lots of money. So again, no one can compel you to give that information because we in our country believe in the secret ballot. Did you know that your great grandma, who is bedridden, can request an absentee ballot? In fact, my grandmother is essentially shut in at this point. She barely leaves the home. She's not well. She's in her late 90s. And she will still, I guarantee you, she will vote in this election. And she will probably request, I mean, she's stubborn. She might try to get up and get out anyway. She feels very strongly about this, but she was would be within her rights to request an absentee ballot. Let's say that you have a family member that is deployed overseas right now. They can mail in their vote, and all of this is expedited for them to make it as simple and painless as possible. These are called absentee ballots. An absentee ballot is one that allows a person to vote without actually physically going to the polling place. We as a country have worked to eliminate as many barriers to voting as possible because we understand that any type of headache might cause someone to choose not to vote, and we feel that it is so important that we are going to do as many things as possible to make it as easy as possible for you to vote. Okay, there's people that might need this. My sick grandma, very possibly. Your cousin or brother or dad in the military deployed overseas. Or maybe you're just going to be traveling. Let's say you're like Michaela. It's your birthday, it's election. Oh man, I'm going to be in Vegas. Well, don't worry. You can request an absentee ballot ahead of time. You can mail it from Vegas if you want. You can mail it ahead of time and then go to Vegas. Once more, the idea is that we want to eliminate excuses. All right, so types of ballots. In the Stone Age, they were called butterfly ballots because you had to physically punch them. Again, punch card ballots. Today, we prefer the computerized ballot because it is backed up by a system which is going to be much more reliable than a simple punch card. After you vote, yay, you get a sticker, you voted. Wear it to school the next day, wear it at work, be proud that you voted. What happens to those votes? Well, election workers take the returns, and a return is just the results of an election. So Little River Community Center is going to collect all of the votes that were cast from that location, say 1,000, maybe 1,500 votes cast in that location. And they have to take those returns to the local election board. And they will send those to the state. And the state canvassing authority is responsible for ensuring that those votes are counted properly. And all of this is done under close scrutiny, and if they make any mistake, all of those votes have to be counted again at great cost. And so it behooves them to do it right the first time. Lastly, and you don't have to do this when you go vote, but you may be asked to fill out an exit poll. An exit poll is a survey taken about how you voted and why you voted that way. Once more, you're not required to fill this out. They might hand it to you at the beginning. They might have a booth set up so you can fill it out at the end. Exit polls are an excellent way to determine who is going to win an election. And also, the exit poll results are matched against the official election results to determine if there has been fraud. So it's in your best interest to take the extra 30 seconds and fill out the exit poll survey. You don't have to once more, but it's just one more safeguard to make sure this is done properly. And so the next thing you'll do after you vote, go get you something to eat, celebrate, yay, that was great. But you're probably going to watch the news or check out social media or whatever way you learn about things as they happen. And media outlets, from the big ones like NPR to New York Times to Fox News to even the local ones like WLOS, are going to try to use the results of the exit poll to predict the election. They're going to try to figure it out. Okay. So each state handles voting in their own way. But there's always the concern that one state's going to screw it up, like Florida did in 2000. And so there have been discussions about the need for national standards to prevent the type of Florida screw-ups that we had in 2000. So by voting...
Wait, what happened in 2000?
So why your vote matters. Even if you want to vote for the Labor Party, it still matters. Why? Well, number one, it is your best way of being listened to. Voters use a variety of sources to inform themselves about candidates. You now have more information in your phone than you ever have in the history of our planet. And you have access to a near infinite amount of information about each candidate. It is very simple to look at previous decisions that candidate has made. We can learn a lot about their personality by studying their life's history. And we should be able to ask them questions. You know, so when our representatives come to talk to us, I plan on researching their voting records, and I will show you guys their voting records. You know, Mr. Henson voted this way on this particular bill. What does this tell us about his career or his political leanings? A word that you'll hear a lot in politics is the electorate. The electorate means all the people who are eligible to vote. All the people who are eligible to vote. So that is all citizens of the United States aged 18 and older. We've also talked about, sadly, sometimes people don't vote. Maybe they don't meet the state requirements. Maybe they're not 18. Maybe they're not yet technically a citizen. And this is the one that admittedly got me when I was 18. I had just turned 18, July 30th of 2000. Well, there was a big election going on, the election of 2000. And because I was a teenager, and like most teenagers, I didn't really think about things or plan ahead, I didn't register to vote. Because at that time, you couldn't just register when you got your driver's license. And so I wanted to vote, but unfortunately, I did not register within the 25 days, so I didn't get to vote in the election of 2000. It frustrated me. There wasn't much I could do about it at the time. Lesson learned, and I voted in every election since. Sometimes, neither candidate closely represents how I feel about things. And so you better believe that I do cast my protest vote in those cases. I do go ahead and research, okay, what are these independent people about? What do they have to say about things? But some people, sadly, don't do that. They don't cast their vote if they feel that neither of the two candidates represent their interest because they feel that their vote won't make a difference. You know, a protest vote is still a powerful one. You know, even if Gary Johnson only got 1% of the vote, had maybe the 20% of independent voters in this country cast their vote for Gary Johnson, he might have won. But maybe that 20% of the independent voters in our country just felt that it wouldn't make a difference. So all 20% of them didn't show up, so he didn't win. Because after all, our country has a problem with apathy. And apathy simply means a lack of interest. You know, because when we feel disconnected from the political process, the first thing we begin to feel is apathy. If nothing I can say to Mr. Henson is going to change his mind, then why should I care? You know, a lot of people do feel that way. Because the reality is, nothing you say individually is likely to change his mind. But if your opinion represents lots of others, we can force his hand. President Johnson didn't want to sign the 64 Civil Rights Act. 1 million people showed up in front of the White House and said, President Johnson, you need to sign the 1964 Civil Rights Act. And so he signed the 1964 Civil Rights Act. You know, those are big moments. But those movements don't happen in isolation. Some people don't vote because they just feel our government sucks. I'm not going to give them my time of day. Many people do vote because they have positive views about our government. Better or worse, it's my government. I have to be involved with it. Did you know there's a relationship in the likelihood that you're going to vote and the amount of education that you've received? Nationally, the wealthier people vote, the more educated people vote, and the older people vote. And that is a statistical likelihood. The less educated vote far less often. The poor vote far less often. And the young vote far less often. But after all, voting gives us a chance to choose those in our government. And the most powerful voice you have is at the local level. At the national level, I get it. You're one of 150 million people casting their vote in 2020. You know, most of you will be eligible to vote in 2020 when Trump runs for re-election. And I get that many of you might not vote because you're like, well, I'm at one in 150 million voters. So some people feel disconnected that way. But guess what? Mr. Henson is going to be one of just a few thousand voters. Your county commissioner will win by hundreds of votes. Those are close elections that not a lot of people participate in, that if you just do it, you'll get a powerful say. And it gives you the chance to voice your opinion. Had more people decided to cast a protest vote, it would have made a big difference in the voice that those independent candidates have. You know, if you don't like the two-party system, don't vote for either of the two parties. Vote independent. And I'm not an independent. But I still feel that way. Because you need to think about what you want to see in our country. And so, yes, it gives you a chance to voice your opinion. Eugene Debs in 1918 ran on an independent ticket, got 10% of the popular vote. And so we're still talking about him 100 years later. He was an independent candidate. Yeah, from jail. today we'll be talking about chapter 10, section 3. And the big idea here is that we need to be informed as the electorate. We are the electorate, the people who vote or not vote for these individuals. And so we need to learn how that process works. So a few that I'm going to throw at you today. Number one, propaganda, political action committee, soft money, which is really tricky to understand, but we'll get to it, and then incumbent. So before we start, let's think about this question. Should a government limit campaign spending? Or even, can limits to campaign spending interfere with a candidate's right or a citizen's right even to free speech? So the steps in running for public office. Let's say that one of you want to go into public office. You hear the spiel from our General Assembly representative and you say, I can do a better job than that guy. Well, do it. Run against him. Why not? So you want to run for office. Congratulations. It's a mature step that I think you should all consider at some point. Well, good luck. You can start a Facebook campaign. It may go viral. But if you really want to get this going, you're going to need to hire a consultant, someone who does this for a living with some experience. Well, guess what? Good consultants cost good money. And money plays a big role in the process of getting elected. The bigger the campaign, the more money you're going to need to pull it off. The purpose of these campaigns are to convince the public to vote for a particular candidate. And you may say, I can do this without money. Congratulations. Go around and individually meet the thousands of people that you will need to convince, assuming they even give you the time of day. Oh, don't worry. I'll use social media. Congratulations. Do you ever read the comments on social media? I don't think they're often very rational. People will hear you, but if you really want your voice to be heard, then you're going to need some money behind it. The purpose of these campaigns, obviously, are to convince the public to vote for a particular candidate. And this part of their job consumes politicians because it takes up so much of their time. How are they going to do it? Well, number one, they need to find out what the public opinion is. How do people feel about these particular issues? You know, it's just like doing market research if you're going to open up a new business. If you find that there is a need, that the public desires something that they don't have, and that a large enough majority of the public really want this thing, that might be an issue you could run on. Secondly, endorsements as propaganda. I just want to define this term for you. Propaganda is a certain idea or message that may involve misleading messages that are designed to manipulate. It's a sales tactic to make yourself sound better than you actually are. Propaganda is a powerful tool in elections. One of the masters of this was Joseph McCarthy. He began accusing all manner of people of being communist, and he used that fear to win elections until finally he was disgraced because he just took it too far. Great example of propaganda. Secondly, the one we're most familiar with are advertisements. Advertisements to create just the right image for a candidate, but also to create a negative image for our opponent. But here's the thing, whether you're using social media or you're going door to door or you're making big speeches or even television commercials, no matter what medium you choose to use, to reach a large number of people is going to require a large amount of money. And so that leads us to where does the money come from? The bigger the election, the higher level of spending. Every election tends to get more expensive because to reach the larger audiences are going to require a greater degree of spending. Many campaigns use propaganda. You've been exposed to it as a daily part of your lives. Again, whether you watch television, read the newspaper, consume social media, whatever outlet that you use to connect to the outside world has often connected you with political candidates who have often tried to influence your opinion. So what does a candidate do with their time? In addition to going around and speaking with people and hearing their concerns, in addition to the time they spend reading bills and deciding on them when Congress is in session or when a president is doing the work of a president in the White House, they also spend a considerable amount of their time soliciting donations or raising campaign funds. Laws and even court decisions like the Citizens United Supreme Court case have established various rules for how political campaigns can be financed. For example, the Federal Election Campaign Act, called FECA, was passed in 1971. It requires that the money that a candidate spends be disclosed for public knowledge. And so you can look it up. For each person that is going to come in and meet with us, you can look up how much money did Congressman Meadows spend in his recent campaign for re-election? You have a right to know that. This law also placed limits to the amount of hard money donated directly to a candidate or a party. Here's the tricky thing. There are limits to how much a person can give directly to a candidate or directly to a party. This is where it gets tricky. That's called hard money. So if you were to be inspired by what the congressman has to say and you were to pull him aside after the presentation and you were to say, "Mr. Congressman, I would like to personally write you a check for $10,000. How does that sound?" He would be federally obligated to tell you, "I can't accept that much money from an individual." This was an effort to limit campaign spending. But don't worry, Mr. Congressman, there's a workaround. There's a big loophole to this law. But after all, it was an effort to limit campaign spending. And I just wanted to show you this to provide evidence that we've been aware of a problem for quite some time. And we've been trying to work to fix this. Next, the Federal Election Commission was created in 1974 as an amendment to the Federal Election Campaign Act. So it was added to that law, and it was created to administer and enforce all of these laws related to elections. Their purpose is to monitor campaign spending, and that's why you can easily access all of this information. You can probably find it straight from their website. There have also been a number of famous Supreme Court cases related to campaign spending. First is Buckley v. Vallejo. The Supreme Court ruled in 1976 that the government could set limits on campaign contributions and that the government could not limit the spending of a candidate's own money. So there have been a few candidates historically that have pledged to use only their own money in their campaigns. Ross Perot is probably the most famous of these. So government, once more, could set limits on campaign contributions, but could not limit the amount of an individual's personal money. There is a public fund that can be used for elections. It's called the Presidential Election Campaign Fund. It was created to establish a public funding source for presidential elections. The money comes each year as part of your taxes. The idea is that our government was hoping to level the playing field when it came to presidential elections. If each candidate gets the same amount of public funding, then money shouldn't be as big of an issue in national elections, theoretically. In fact, even third-party candidates could qualify for funding through the Presidential Election Campaign Fund. But the real question is, if $1 billion is being spent by each candidate, where is that $1 billion coming from? So private funding comes from various sources. It could be individual citizens. It could be one of you pull Mark Meadows aside and he can accept a certain degree of money directly from you. So individual citizens, possibly. Could be from corporations, which, again, according to Citizens United, corporations in terms of campaign finance are legally considered people and can donate to political action committees with no restraint. Could be from labor unions, which once more can donate to these types of committees. Interest groups, again, you know, maybe it's something you're passionate about, like the environment or like crime and public safety or healthcare, whatever it is, there's a political action group that is working towards that end that you can support financially. And the big one, of course, political action committees. What are these? Well, a political action committee is a political organization established possibly by a corporation, maybe a labor union, or maybe one of these special interest groups. And its purpose is to support candidates by contributing money. Now, once more, there are limits to how much money they can directly donate to a campaign. The first thing they do is they max that out. But since political action committees can also use soft money, which is something we'll learn about in just a moment, they can get away with spending unlimited amounts of money. Unlimited amounts of money on political campaigns. Okay, so what is soft money? Well, soft money are donations given to political parties that are not designed for a particular candidate's election campaign. So if I want to donate $10 billion to the Republican Party, then perhaps. There's a couple of caveats. This soft money cannot come from individuals or super PACs. But there are no limits to these types of contributions. No limits. Okay, so where's the money going? It may be spent by interest groups in the media. Again, that's those television commercials you see paid for by XPAC, paid for by this political action committee. Now, often this money is given by political action committees to incumbents. An incumbent is a politician who has already been elected to office. So Congressman Meadows has already been elected. He's an incumbent. Congressman or General Assembly Representative Henson has already been elected. Therefore, these are incumbents. They are your current representatives. And this money can be given to them by a political action committee. And that means they're probably going to have a lot more money than whoever is going to challenge them. And that makes getting rid of those people rather difficult. Well, in 2002, the Bipartisan Campaign Reform Act, known as the McCain-Feingold Act, was passed. And it set limits on who could raise money. It even set time restrictions on televised campaign ads. New limits on hard money contributions, that is, contributions directly to the candidate. So limits on soft money, that is money to the party. Limits on hard money, that is directly to the candidate. This was challenged at the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court upheld the ruling. But of course, the use of social media has provided a whole new platform for campaigning. Even memes. I mean, how many political memes have you seen? Maybe you don't have the attention to watch a commercial, but you're going to binge out on some silly memes. Guess what? A lot of those memes are bought and paid for by professionals. Be a sweet career, right? Even think of articles online. You know, these days, if you Google something, like Google, is so-and-so dumb? Often the first articles that are going to appear are going to be written by professionals who do this for a living, and many of those articles are biased, meant to persuade you to feel a certain way about an issue. Great examples, BuzzFeed, Huffington Post, even The Onion, the stupid satire publication, is a form of these types of media created to influence. And of course, videos. Last question. Do you think that the McCain-Feingold Act will make it more difficult? And once more, research that Citizens United to find out more information about the effect of the Supreme Court case that ruled the corporations are people and how that influences campaign spending. So today we'll be talking about how a democracy can survive. Yeah. Please. How it will hopefully survive. And so here are a few terms that we'll be looking at. Yes, we will finally get into the Electoral College, and I will do my best to confuse you to death about it. Yes, we will also get into your power to change laws and how it's not simple, but it is possible. And then finally, we will get into how to get rid of bad leaders, because you have the right to do that. You totally have the right to do that, and I'm excited to explain it to you. First, the question, should voters vote directly on specific issues instead of picking representatives to do this for us? It's not a simple question. Within our pockets lies the capacity to pull this off, perhaps. Currently, we elect professionals to make these decisions for us, who read these lengthy bills for a living. It is technically feasible, but it has not yet been attempted. And to be honest, right now, we've got to fix our voter turnout problem before we fix anything else, because we can't have 10% of the American electorate making all of our decisions for us. That would be a big problem. So as we get in, the different types of elections that go on through our political system. What I want to help you understand is there's more than just Trump versus Hillary. There's more than just a general election. There are primary elections, that is, where Ted Cruz, Marco Rubio, Jeb Bush, Donald Trump, etc., have to compete for the nomination of the Republican Party. And the same on the Democrats. It was Hillary Clinton versus Bernie Sanders versus a few other folks you've probably never heard of before, also competing for the Democratic nomination. There are special elections. That is, if Congressman Meadows decides to retire for family reasons, whatever, or if he passes away suddenly, there would need to be a special election. There can be elections on particular issues. And so these are just some of the ones that we're getting into today. But first off, we'll start with the big one, the general election, right? And that's the one everybody likes to look at and talk about and argue about because it's the one that we are exposed to the most. It's always held after primary elections, and election day is always the first Tuesday after the first Monday in November. Confused yet? If you're not sure, just Google it. But it's always going to be, for whatever reason that rule exists, the first Tuesday after the first Monday in November. Also, who is running in the general election? In every general election, that is every 4 years, all seats in the House of Representatives are up for grabs. And one third of the seats in the Senate are at stake every even numbered year. This is 2018. It's an even numbered year. So when Tom Tillis comes to meet with you guys or his representative, they want your vote. And of course, the presidential election only occurs every 4 years, right? 2016, and then again in 2020, every 4 years. And there are also state and local elections that go on. So it would be in your best interest to do some research about what the ballot's going to look like in November of this year. And there are certainly disputed elections. If there needs to be a runoff election, meaning that the results were disputed from the previous election and they need to run again, that is a possibility. And that could occur on a ballot in a general election. Next, there are issue elections. These are often called referendums. You do have the right to vote on particular issues. Currently, it's not an easy process to get that issue onto the ballot for the average voter. But it does happen, and there is generally one referendum item on every general election ballot. There almost always is, but each one of them represents a big movement to get that on there. And so once more, a referendum is a way for citizens to vote on state or local laws. More examples of issue elections. There are initiatives. And this one's really exciting. Initiatives are a way in which individual citizens can propose new laws or new state constitutional amendments. So let's say that gerrymandering is a subject of great concern to you. Little squiggly districts bug you. And they don't just bug you or you forget about it when you eat lunch. They bother you to the point that you can't sleep. And you want to get it fixed. And you start following the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court does, well, let's say they do nothing. Let's say they rule that the proposed solution is not going to be effective. You just can't leave it alone. You're just bothered by the fact that democracy is ceasing to function on this particular part of our government. Well, guess what? You can do something about it. Because there's other people that are bothered by this too. You're not the only one. And there is a petition going on, a nationwide petition, that just needs enough signatures to make it happen. And an initiative is a way to amend a state's constitution. And this can be done through a proposition. A proposition is a formal petition asking for a new law. Now, there's a formal process. You know, you can't just get your dog to sign it. You can't sign it twice. Every signature has to be validated. But if you obtain enough signatures, the initiative goes on to the ballot. That means Leia has started a movement that now voters of Henderson County will have to decide on. And guys, laws have been changed this way. Other types of elections. There are special elections. For example, let's say that a local election is so close, and I'm sure there have been cases where there was a tie. What do you do? You know, we can't just have people start killing each other in the streets. We need a backup plan. Let's say there is a tie or it's too close to call, like one by one vote or something like that. You know, I had a friend who ran for local office in Polk County, Tennessee. He lost by 19 votes. Now, to be fair, only a couple hundred people voted. It was kind of depressing. However, he could have done some math to see if it was within the statistical margin of error, and if it was, he might have been able to request a special election, or a runoff election, that is. But did you know that there is even a way to get rid of poor leaders? It's called a recall election. A recall election is a special election in which citizens can vote to remove a public official from office. It is a vote of non-confidence of the American people. It's not easy to do, once more. At the local level, you've got to get X amount of signatures to have a quorum, meaning enough to actually put this on there. At the national level, we'd be talking about a lot of signatures. So the next question is, you know, what do you guys think of this cycle? You know, should it be every 2 years? Should it be more often? Some people think there should be term limits on these congressional seats. But of course, the exciting one, right? Presidential elections. Yay, everybody knows about that one. Everybody has an opinion about those people. Presidential elections have three major steps. The candidate has to be nominated, obviously, by their party. They then campaign and spend about $1 billion these days, which is crazy. And then we vote. Well, half of us do. Okay, so how's all this break down? National conventions are held every 4 years to determine who the candidate of a particular party is going to be. Originally, the decision was made here. Once upon a time, the American people didn't vote on who was going to be the candidate. It was chosen within the party. And in an effort to make the process more democratic, the parties now allow the states to decide, state by state, who they want their candidate to be. And so the Democratic National Convention is still a really neat thing to watch. It's worth watching if you're into politics. Each state at the convention declares who their candidate for president for that party is going to be. And it's kind of cool. It's a big mass rally. Each state's representative stands up and says, Delaware for so-and-so. Connecticut for so-and-so. But today, they're really just there to communicate the results that we already know. Okay, so elements to a campaign. Number one are the electors. The electors in the Electoral College are people appointed to vote in the presidential elections for the major candidates. You get to vote. Here's where it gets confusing. You get to vote in the election. But it is the electors who decide who the president will be. Now, each of these electors are pledged to a particular candidate. And this is part of the Electoral College system. The Electoral College system is where this group of people called the Electoral College, made up of the electors, are named by each state legislature to select the president and the vice president. Each state gets one electoral vote for each member of Congress, and Washington, D.C. gets three. So there are a total of 538 electors that make up the Electoral College. These are the people who choose the President of the United States. The numbers change each year, or each election, depending on survey results, when congressional maps are redrawn. Basically, North Carolina has X amount of congressmen that we send to the United States Congress. Each district is one congressman. That is the number of electoral votes that we get. California is the largest state. They have the highest number of electoral votes. Montana is a huge state in terms of size, but is one of the smallest states in terms of population. Ergo, they get some of the fewest electoral votes. That's how the Electoral College works. Now, most states, North Carolina included, use a winner-take-all system. This means that if a particular candidate wins that state's popular vote, all of the electoral votes from that state go to that candidate. So let's assume, I'm making this number up, that North Carolina has 10 districts. That means all 10 would go to whoever won in that popular vote. Let's assume that Montana has 2 districts. That means they only get 2 electoral votes. And so what this means is that as long as the candidate wins the majority, or at least the plurality, more of the electoral votes than anyone else, they're the president. So, these electoral votes are sent to Congress to be counted, and whoever gets the most wins. Wins the general election. Now, of course, a lot of people ask why. Why is this? Why does it have to be so confusing? Why do we have a situation in which a person can lose the popular vote but win the Electoral College and become our next president? And why has that happened 5 times in our country's history? And we also have to ask, why are 4 of the 5 Republicans? One was a Whig, to be fair. No, one was a Federalist. But yeah, I believe 4 of the 5 were Republicans. So this leads us to the question of problems with the existing system. A candidate may win the popular vote by a small percentage in states, or in the recent election by 3 million votes, yet they lose the popular vote by a large percentage in states that have few electoral votes. So let's say, and what this creates is a really complicated path to victory that every candidate has a team of experts that has studied meticulously. And what they found out is there are about 8 swing states in the United States. That doesn't mean they're married, but they date outside of that. That means they go Democrat some years, they go Republican some years. North Carolina is a swing state. But there are also states that are solid red. Texas will vote for Satan if he is a Republican. They will. Louisiana will vote for Hitler if he runs Republican. New York will vote for Joseph Stalin if he runs as a Democrat. There are some that are solid blue. And unless something big changes, they're going to stay that way. There are some that are solid red. North Carolina is what we call a purple state. It's a swing state. Now, here's the thing. When the Republicans are coming up with their strategy, they look at the solid red states and they go, okay, we don't even really need to spend money there. We know they're going to vote red, no matter what. So we're not going to waste our time with those people. But we're not so sure about North Carolina. And that's where it gets really complicated. Then they're going to zoom in on North Carolina. And they're going to go, Asheville's going to vote Democrat no matter what. So we're not going to waste as much time there. However, there are Republicans in Asheville that might not feel their vote matters because they're in Asheville. We got to make sure they vote. And so they're going to look up those people's addresses, and they're going to target them directly. In the really contested areas, someone's going to show up at their house with a box of cookies or something.
Seriously? Like, they'll actually show
up? Every single house. Someone, they canvass the area. They might not be able to give cookies legally, but they're going to find some way to make you feel appreciated. Again, in the heavily contested areas. Of course, the question is, how do we change this? Can we change this? There are some who feel that it needs to be abolished. But it's not a simple process. The bill has come up in Congress over 100 times to get rid of this system, but it has not yet been successful.